this was real racing. This is cycling like it was 100 years ago.
You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast. Brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Well, chaps, whose voice was that and what race were they talking about? Francois Tomaso, do you know?
It was not an Italian accent. It was not a Spanish accent. So my guess is, well, I think you have quite a clue there.
Yes, it was a Belgian accent. It was Hugo Corvitz of Het Nieuwsblad, a man who's, well, he's not been covering races for 100 years, but he certainly knows a good bike race when he sees it. And he loved today's race from Bruges to Dapan, once the 3 days of Dapan, now kind of rebranded as Brugge Dapana. And oh my goodness, it was quite a day's racing, windy, cold. But once we kind of accepted the conditions, certainly once some of the riders accepted the conditions, we saw a really thrilling race. But it was one of three big races going on today. You, Francois, in Marseille, are kind of, you were right in the centre of the action in a way, because with the Giro happening in Italy, the Vuelta in Spain, and Dapan up in Belgium, you're kind of right in the middle of it,
yeah,
geographically speaking.
Yeah, really. I guess that had I been in Lyon, it would have been even closer to the center of the, you know, of the cycling universe today. But I was not far. And I was actually watching the three races unfolding from, you know, on two computers and a TV set. So I was kind of, you know, on board, kind of a big ship and trying to see everything at once. I hope, you know, it won't get me confused and I won't mix it up altogether. But it was exciting. I must say, actually, probably the Bruges-Dapan race was the most exciting of the three.
Well, there's a controversial opinion. We'll be talking about that a bit later on. Lionel Burney, not Watford. I should say where I am now. I'm at the Bay of the Somme services outside a Shell service station. Might go in and get myself a bag of crisps and a bottle of water a bit later on, treat myself. But Lionel, you're in not Watford. How did you enjoy the three races today?
Well, I had my three screens going again. I didn't get as confused as I did yesterday. And, I started off with a lovely thin crust pizza. Then I had a deep pan pizza. I had some Belgian stew. And then I had some little pinchos, which are very popular in the Basque Country and Navarra, aren't they? So, a very filling afternoon it was too.
I'm hoping to emulate you, but on the liquid side at the end of this episode, you know, bottle of Italian wine, bottle of Spanish wine, and a beer, maybe. We'll see.
Well, you were lucky, Lionel, being able to eat, because Belgium felt very shut down. That was one of the surreal aspects today at the race. It felt like Belgium was closing down or had closed down. It was very difficult to get even a coffee in Bruges, and certainly lunch in Dapana was difficult. It was impossible. So it was strange.
So you've not eaten, and your reward is a service station sandwich.
Will you be back before the curfew? Because, you know, we have curfew in France.
I'm back in France now, so I'm only 45 minutes from home, in fact. But, it was a strange kind of atmosphere, and it felt, you know, there was a point where this race made a lot of sense today, because it fell between Flanders and Roubaix, and as it was with Roubaix cancelled, the riders and the teams held on for this race because it's a World Tour race, but not the most prestigious race. And it did, there was a sort of part of me standing in Bruges this morning wondering why I was there, but as I say, what then unfolded on the road was really enthralling, and it was served up some fantastic entertainment. And at the start in Bruges, on the front of the grid were Mathieu van der Poel, who of course won the Tour of France a few days ago, and Mark Cavendish, possibly riding his last ever race. I did speak to him at the finish, but we'll cover Dapan a bit later on. What are the headlines from today, Lionel?
Well, the headlines are, Richard, the Giro d'Italia's 17th stage went from Bassano del Grappa to Madonna di Campiglio, where In the past, only Marco Pantani and Mikel Landa have won. Of course, it's also where Marco Pantani was kicked out of the 1999 Giro. He'd won the stage and looked set to win that Giro, but he registered a high hematocrit level and was out of the race the next day. So a sort of almost notorious place in Giro history. And, well, we were expecting a big GC battle. That didn't really materialise. We'll talk about the Giro stage in part one. It was won by Ben O'Connor, the Aussie rider, young Aussie rider with NTT Pro Cycling. Much needed victory for them. He went one better than yesterday when he finished second to Jan Tratnik, of course. In part two, we will talk about the 3 days of Dapana, which was won by Yves Lampaert of De Koninck Quickstep. Richard, you were there. It was, well, it was absolutely Flandrien, wasn't it? I'm not surprised Hugo loved it. The perfect race for them, really, because 109 riders pulled out. only about 50 finishers, I think. And an impressive win. You know, a De Koninck Quickstep victory is not a surprise, I guess. But it was another important victory added to Yves Lampaert's list of Flandrian wins. And, well, the other notable incident there was that Mathieu van der Poel ended up in a ditch. He ran off the side of the road and came to a rather uncomfortable looking stop in the ditch, quite a turnaround from being on cloud nine after winning the Tour of Flanders on Sunday, of course. And then in part three, we will talk about the Vuelta stage two, a sort of watered down version of yesterday's stage, really. All the same GC riders, with maybe one or two exceptions, were in the front group again, and it was a huge win for Movistar, only their second win of the season. Marc Soler won the stage for Movistar. Coincidentally, Soler won Movistar's only other race this season, a stage of the Challenge Mallorca back in the spring.
You are listening to The Grandest Tour by the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker, flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iwoca.co.uk, iwoca.co.uk.
Thank you very much to iWoca for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. iWoca is in the business of lending money to small businesses, and if you run a small business, that might be of interest to you. Go to iwoca.co.uk. They've also been accredited for CBILS, which is the government-backed Coronavirus Business Interruption Loan Scheme, which is helping businesses that have been most affected by the coronavirus crisis this year, which is obviously ongoing. And under that scheme, businesses can borrow between £50,001 and £350,000 for up to 5 years. There's no interest or repayments required for a year. You can repay early with no fees, and you'll get the personal touch from iWoca staff, so they will understand your business. And so when you need to talk to them, you'll feel like you're talking to a human being about your business. So go to iwoca.co.uk if that sounds like something your small business could benefit from.
Well, as you said earlier, Lionel, Ben O'Connor won the stage today. He went so close yesterday. It'd be too harsh to say that he made a mess of it yesterday, but after catching Jan Tratnik, that was his opportunity to win. And he sort of squandered it, you felt, watching it. And it's unusual that you get another chance, certainly one so quickly, but he worked hard, and actually his team worked hard to create that opportunity for him again today. They had numbers in that breakaway at the Giro. But, you know, it's hard to overstate how important that win is, both for him, because he was a hugely promising young rider a couple of years ago, still young, but his career appeared to be slightly derailed the last couple of years, and he was ill in Sicily. I spoke to him there, and he really wasn't enjoying the start of the Giro, but he's come round. Our colleague Ciro Scognamiglio at Gazzetta del Sport has tweeted tonight that he believes there is positive news about the future of that team, and that it may well be saved. It sounds like a new sponsor may be interested, and Ben O'Connor's win today will not have done him or the team any harm at all, will it?
Absolutely not. I mean, it's been a long time coming, hasn't it? We remember The last Grand Tour stage win for this team was Edvald Bosenhagen in, I think, Salon de Provence, François, in right towards the end of the 2017
tour. When he went the right way around the boat.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, he did. And, you know, that was a bit of prior knowledge that he perhaps had over others. Although I remember there was a bit of discussion. Oh, everyone knew which way to go round the roundabout. Just some did and some didn't. But yeah, they played it very well, didn't they, NTT Pro Cycling today? They got numbers into that group, not quite as many as Movistar, but we'll probably talk about that a little bit later on. But O'Connor had Louis Menkes in there, and he also had Emmanuel Gebrigzabia in there as well. And that I think would have bolstered confidence, and the fact that he went so well yesterday but just came up short really was due to a couple of things. One, the course didn't suit him quite as well as today's course. He's much more of a natural climber, whereas yesterday was a bit more of almost a sort of Tour of Lombardy type finish, wasn't it? Lots of climbing and descending, a bit more technical rather than a proper sort of mountain stage. And of course he's had to make that big effort to get across to Tratnik. And that gave Tratnik thinking time, you know, and all of the advantage was with Tratnik. And if there was a mistake yesterday, well, he rectified it today by just going out on the front foot. He seized the initiative. You know, there were several really dangerous riders in there, weren't there? Thomas de Gendt, Ilner Zakarin, and the man that was chasing him, Herman Pernsteiner, Daniel's dark horse from the first week, who started very well, then had a difficult few days and slipped right down the GC. And at one point, when the break had sort of 8.5-9 minutes, Pernsteiner was all the way up to third overall in the virtual standings. Slipped back a little bit, but he has nevertheless moved up 4 places tonight and is just outside the top 10. So a good day's work for Bahrain McLaren, and a good couple of days' work for both Bahrain McLaren and NTT Pro Cycling.
Mm, yeah, well, a couple of points. First of all, I'm thrilled to be here on the podcast talking about the Giro, because as you know, I've never ever set foot on the Giro. So I mean, to be
next year,
Francois, next year
on
it, hopefully. But it's true, it's the only Grand Tour I haven't done, and it's exciting to be talking about it. I was wondering, I mean, it's a question, you know, that's been around ever since Bjarne Riis made his return to the World Tour, but how much of an impact is had in bringing back that team towards success? He was talking to French television today on the finish line and saying, you know, how he talked to O'Connor the night before and told him, you know, if he'd managed to be so close once, there was no reason why he shouldn't try again, like, you know, some other young riders like Hirschi on the Tour de France showed, you know, you have to try again, and it worked. So my impression is that, you know, Riis might be bringing something there for O'Connor. Well, we all remember, but I remember vividly 2 years ago watching the Giro on TV and how close he was to to make it into the yet to give up, but he was a GC contender. He was close to the top 10, if I remember well. So, you know, a young guy coming of age at 24, I think we can put him in the same category as all this up and coming generation. And Cyril Guimard as well was saying that a guy who can, you know, be riding so well 2 days in succession in the third week of a Grand Tour is obviously a great prospect for a GC win. And the last point I wanted to make is about Thomas de Gendt, because as you said, Lionel, he was probably the leading animator of the break today, as he usually is. I mean, his turns were again very strong, and he played a major part in that break. But again, doesn't seem to have the edge yet in the past, and we've seen him attack many times in the Tour de France. We've seen him, you know, going for these breaks and not succeeding, not going all the way. So he is, can we put again as well in this declining generation, and is it going to be more and more difficult for Degan to win a solo break like he did, you know, in the Stelvio. We're going to the Stelvio tomorrow, as he did in 2012 when he won at the Stelvio. Degan is still there in the breaks, but it seems to be struggling to win them these days.
Well, the battle for the stage was really quite engrossing, wasn't it? And this question, we see this so often when a team is on the brink of extinction, that the riders can pull something out of themselves. And I think NTT have ridden pretty well initially, rallying around the bird with the broken wing, Domenico Pozzovivo, and riding pretty impressively as a collective, and now sort of individually. Well, Ben O'Connor has been riding very well. Some of them will no doubt have already arranged moves elsewhere. Louis Menkes is off to join the circus, isn't he, apparently? Wante Circus stepping up to World Tour. I think he's joining them. I believe Edvald Boasenhagen may be going back to Ineos, but Ben O'Connor didn't seem to have anything set up, and he is definitely a guy that they could build something around. The other story that we're following in the Giro, and it's, I've seen one or two sort of sniffy comments about the Giro not really catching fire, but I find it pretty compelling because we're now deep into the third week and we do not have a clue really who's going to win it. It still seems like a very open race with major twists still to come. João Almeida is obviously still in the pink jersey and not showing any real signs of weakness yet, although that's a big caveat because the major climbs are still to come. But has it gripped you, Francois, the Giro?
Well, yeah. I mean, as I said, I think it's really exciting because, well, for a Frenchman, of course, Arnaud Démare's sprint victories were quite exciting. I think that we've known Giros with much more mountains than we've seen this year, and maybe much earlier in the race, than we've seen this year. And I mean, we've seen the other GC, the other Grand Tours have had earliest mountain stages. So maybe it made up for as you say, much closer race, a much more exciting race in terms of the. So it's not exciting in terms of the GC because they don't seem to be. Nobody seems to be taking the upper end. Maybe with maybes we can change things. Maybe with Geraint Thomas still in the race, it would have been a different race. But or maybe with Remco Evenepoel leading Duncan at Quickstep, it would have been a different race. But this is the race we've got, and it's an exciting one. I think we're going to see much clearer tomorrow after the Stelvio, if weather permitting. But yeah, it's really exciting, and I would be really struggling if you asked me to put money in on one of the riders still in contention. I'll be struggling a little bit. I don't think I'd go for I think I'd follow the trend and not put my money on the old guard, and I haven't seen Nibali do anything really convincing yet. So yeah, I might put my money on a young up and coming Ineos.
Oh wow!
I don't know. But in any case, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. It's nice to see a Portuguese, young Portuguese, because it's another nation. Well, it's always been a cycling nation, but with ups and downs. But I think, as you say, he's been doing a great job. It reminds me a lot of Alaphilippe in last year's Tour de France. Like, he's not a real climber, but I mean, he fights hard, like he did the other day, to keep his jersey from Wilco Kelderman, and we'll see what he does tomorrow. I think he might lose it tomorrow, but well, you don't know. We don't know the limits of these
guys. I do like the way Almeida rides with his head sort of tilted back, stylistically. I do like that. It's obviously when he's making quite a big effort, but as the impression you're left with is that he looks incredibly relaxed. I don't know. Shall we hear from our audio diarist, James Knox, a teammate at De Koenig Quickstep, of course. Another day ticked off, another day successful defence of the pink jersey.
Hi, everyone. Tucked up in bed again after a long, hard day, yet again. Another day closer to Milan. I guess we can say, in hindsight, all the way it finished, everything went according to plan. Similar story as the day before. Breakaway Didn't go until the first long climb. There, things got a bit messy today. Plenty of attacks, had to be in front, close a few moves myself, spend a bit of legs, but most importantly, tried to have a bit of a presence and demoralise guys from behind. So yeah, in the end, barring Pernsteiner, more or less a breakaway of guys outside of the GC, despite it being very strong climbers. Obviously, it was took at least 5 kilometres of the first climb to properly stick, so all we saw were strong guys in the front. You had to be strong to be in there. And from there, we were able to regroup for a bit. Alvaro was behind in the gruppetto, but Elio and Ballerini, on top of all the attacks and following moves that they did in the first 40 kilometres before the climb, set a very impressive tempo all day. Sort of negated, you know, any attacks. Made it hard for people to think about going anywhere when we were all in front still with 7 guys, 6 in the end. Big long run into Madonna di Campaglio, I'm not sure, I can't remember. Sunweb turned the screw, but couldn't turn it too much today. They quickly started popping off, which was very, very nice to see from our perspective. And then they were just left with the two strong lads, Hindley and Kelderman, who couldn't seem to get away or do much damage. I was left flapping around trying to get back to that group, but Masnada took control and rode a strong, steady pace, I should say, to keep it under control. And we'll take that. We'll take that for day one of three of the big mountains in the final week. And then, yeah, we could just roll down 5K on the bikes to the hotel. So that's where I am now, just 5K from the summit, 6K from the summit. Stood by the side of the road, clapping the gruppetto past, giving Alvaro a bit of a shout. He's in the room with me. Obviously not his favourite day. And I've been trying to pick up his morale since. Got him a packet of crisps, which we shared. He's a bit dead, as you can imagine, but getting closer to Milan, which was his big goal other than winning the stage. And then, yeah, so tomorrow's the big, big challenge, Stelvio. It seems to be going ahead. Weather was pretty fantastic today, I have to say, for end of October. Already quite high today. We got to 1700 metres, maybe even a little 1750, I can't remember exactly, on the passes today. There was snow on the top, but it was chilly over the top, but you know, we had clothing passed up and prepared for it and it wasn't too bad. But Stelvio is a different story. If everything's clear and dry, hopefully it'll be okay, but it is high, it's very high. I've done training camps in the Vigno in July whilst the Tour de France goes going on with the team, and obviously done the Stelvio a few times from there, and even in perfect July day, it's cold. So sure, there'll be a lot of snow. Sure, that means there'll be water on the road. And yeah, I guess from the racing point of view, and hope we can get up and over it without any issues. Already whinged plenty enough, haven't I, about not really enjoying the cold and wet. So yeah, the Stelvio really is a challenge in that regard. But we appear to have hit a nice little clear spot in the weather for the high mountains. And let's hope that continues, because, you know, I think it quickly gets very, very messy at that height if the weather changes. You know, will be more or less 0 degrees freezing on the top, you know, and then if you start getting wet or, yeah, riding into clouds or whatever, it will be a messy day. And then the finish off, straight off the bottom on Lago di Cancano, which I've also done from Livigno. Nice little sinuous loads of hairpins to get up there. Not actually sure where they put the finish line, because it's a pretty narrow little road. There's some gravel that goes out into like a car park to go to the lake. I don't know if we go all the way across there, but it's a small road all the way up to the finish. And then we seem to have got news through that stage 20 has been altered. I heard, because I don't know if it's, is it because, I actually don't know. I don't know why it's got all this. It's because of Col d'Agnello is not passable, or apparently there was talk we couldn't go into France. So I'm not sure what the reason is exactly. But either way, it sounds like it's changed. Laps at Sestriere, a bit different. So yeah, we'll just have to be ready for tomorrow, first things first. Another big day coming up.
Well, as you say, Rich, it was a slightly lukewarm battle in the GC today, wasn't it? João Almeida, James Knox and Fausto Masnada will tick that one off as a job well done. They didn't truly come under a great deal of threat today. It did look that Sunweb were going to do the same thing they did on Sunday and really rip it up. But notably, Chris Hamilton was not at the front as late in the stage today. It was left to Jai Hindley, and there was a moment where Hindley accelerated and the elastic started to stretch a bit, but the Kelderman didn't react off the back of that. Almeida was very alert, Theo Gegenhardt was very alert, and nothing really happened. I think that's possibly a combination of things. One, the climb today, although some difficult bits, is relatively straightforward, and perhaps the thought of having to go over the Stelvio in the freezing cold tomorrow is on their minds. An awful lot of climbing tomorrow. It really is an absolutely classic last week of the Giro stage, isn't it? And well, with the Stelvio in mind, let's hear from one of our audio diarists, Joe Dombrowski, about the prospects of riding over the Stelvio in what could be pretty chilly conditions. The weather forecast is looks to be fair, but it could be sort of 4 degrees at the top. Daniel came up with some figures off the top of his head, I think, earlier in the week, saying that the wind chill on the descents could be minus 40. I'm not going to subject that to a fact check because I have absolutely no idea, but it does strike me that the descending is going to be really pretty cold.
I can tell you without fact checking that's very cold.
That is very cold, isn't it? Yeah. That's not well, the element of it I wanted to fact check. let's hear what Joe Dombrowski says about the race going over the Stelvio in what is now getting towards the end of October, and whether or not the extreme weather protocol is going to come into play.
So many times in the Grand Tours, there's a WhatsApp group of the riders, usually one rider from each team, who basically acts as a representative for bringing up issues that they see with the course in terms of safety or with weather. I hadn't heard anything about the Stelvio. I know it's supposed to be sunny tomorrow, and yeah, for me personally, I think it's perfectly fine to stick with the plan. I think that it's important that the riders have a voice, but also I think sometimes we have to be careful about griping about the weather conditions or course safety, because it can turn into sort of the boy who cried wolf if every single time it's a bit cold or rainy that we want to change. But as far as I can see, I think everything for tomorrow is perfectly fine, and I haven't heard anything otherwise. And for I don't know that anyone on our team is on this WhatsApp group. I don't know if it's not happening in this Giro, but I had heard, the only thing I've heard is that potentially Saturday's stage, they could take out Colle Agnello, because I think on Friday the weather is supposed to turn, and we may have some precipitation, and it could be that at 2,700 meters that precipitation is snow. But yeah, from my point of view, I think tomorrow's stage is perfectly fine, and I think, like I said, we have to be a little bit careful about how often we're asking for changes, because otherwise you start to alter the nature of the race, and at some point maybe the race organizers don't take you seriously if every time the weather is a bit not what we all want, if every time we're asking for a change.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting what Dombrowski's saying and what we're all saying about the weather and these names, Madonna di Campiglio, the Stelvio. Usually in the winter, I cover alpine skiing, and these are you know household names for alpine skiing fans as well. The Stelvio is a very famous downhill course, and Madonna di Campiglio, a very famous ski resort as well. And you know, Slovenia being the rising cycling power. Do you know the two Slovenians, one in Madonna, in alpine skiing, of course, in Madonna di Campiglio. One of them, the first one, Bozan Krizaj, won the award as the best Slovenian sports of the year 6 times. So Primož Roglič, who only won it once, is still a long way to go to beat Krizaj. Anyway, that was my skiing moment.
Well, sticking with mountains, just the last bit of business from the Giro today. We've been watching this battle between Ruben Guerrero of EF Pro Cycling and Giovanni Visconti of Vini Zabu. And, well, they were both in the break yesterday, weren't they? And Visconti got the upper hand and stretched his lead. Today, Guerrero was in the break, Visconti was not. And, well, the Portuguese hoovered up the points and he's now 50 points ahead of Visconti. By no means a done deal, this, for the EF Pro Cycling rider, but a nice lead to have going into, well, lots of points on offer tomorrow and also on Saturday. And just a quick word on Saturday's stage, we know already that they will not be going into France. They won't be going over the Agnello or the Izoard at Francois. That's because the French have effectively withdrawn permission for the race to go onto French soil because of the restrictions regarding coronavirus at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. The whole of France has been now put into a kind of a, you know, sanitary emergency, as they say, and as a result, the prefect of the region decided that the Giro couldn't come over to France. And I think from the mayor's point of view and from the region's point of view, that the main thing is to maintain, you know, to make sure, you know, holiday goers can come and ski in Briançon and in the area in December, so that, you know, the Giro can wait. And But the tourists, you know, they really want to have the ski season saved.
You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast. Brought to you by iWaka. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Today, we're at the Driedaagse Brugge de Pannen.
Well, that was the sound of the bells in Bruges, not so much tolling but playing this beautiful music. Throughout the morning, the riders were lining up nearby and we could hear the bells. Weren't a lot of people around. That was another of the strange aspects of this and other races recently. There was a riders presentation, teams presentation, but I don't really know who for other than TV, because there were no crowds around. Partly that was explained by the weather as well. It was raining and it was cold and it was pretty miserable. And as said earlier, I think I did wonder what I was doing there at one point.
You were covering the race, Richard.
I know, but it felt, you know, there are some races like Tour of Flanders on Sunday. Okay, it was a strange Tour of Flanders, but there's still a sense of occasion there. And that's not so apparent at this race and some other races too, and especially when there are no spectators around. The thing that, you know, grabbed the attention was the quality of the field, you know, from Van der Poel to Mark Cavendish to all the De Koninck Quick, or most of the De Koninck Quick Step stars. The only guy really missing was Wout van Aert of the riders you would expect to shine in a race like this. And all these riders, or certainly a lot of them, and a lot of the specialists in this type of terrain and in these types of conditions, really put on a show. You know, as soon as the flag dropped, the race was on, and it was a brilliant, brilliant race with a fascinating kind of battle that would have been even more fascinating had Van der Poel not crashed, because in that front group at that point, you had four De Koninck Quick Steps and three Alps and Fenixes. And, you know, the Alps and Fenix guys, they were faster. Van der Poel, Merlier, faster finishers. So you could argue that they perhaps had the upper hand there. And it would have been really interesting to see how that played out between those two teams. And actually, Alps and Fenix deserve a lot of credit because, you know, a lot of people had them down as a one-man band. But they've ridden as a team extremely well this year. And we're going to see them in much bigger races next year. I was racing to the finish with Philippe Martens, the press officer at Lotto Soudal. We were racing because the race had been shortened due to the conditions. And then when we got there, we decided it had been lengthened again. They'd shortened it and then added a bit.
Somebody in the organising or that decided, and then some gnarly old Flandrian said, no.
I can imagine.
And make it back to normal and add 40 more kilometres.
but, you know, we were talking in the last part about extreme weather protocol, and as you were watching riders literally being blown off the road, that you could have made an argument for the conditions being dangerous. And yet, you know, the reactions of certainly the riders who finished up there at the finish was that they didn't have a miserable time out there. They loved it. They loved it. Riders who train and race in these conditions a lot and you know, have perfected the art or mastered the art of riding in windy conditions like that really enjoyed the opportunity to show what they can do. And there was a funny moment in Hugo Kurvitz, who we heard from at the top of the program. He was standing just beyond the line with a big smile on his face, and John Degenkolb was coming towards us, and he just looked like he was fighting his bike all day. He finished fourth in the end, and he looked completely finished at the end, and he was running towards us, and Hugo said to him, "Nice race," and Degenkolb just started laughing. So it was a great day out. I have to say, was it a good spectacle on the telly box?
Well, I love this kind of racing anyway, and first of all, I hope I'm not going to get cancelled for my terrible Flandrian impression earlier. I mean, I meant absolutely no disrespect at all. But as a one day race, it is a kind of strange one, isn't it? I think you're absolutely right. Had it been, you know, the precursor to the Paris-Roubaix happening as it should have done on Sunday, I think there would have been more point to it. And yet it still survives and thrived today as a means to an end. It was an event on its own, and reinvented as a one-day race, it has got a kind of a future as part of the Flandrian Classics. Just a little bit of trivia on the history of it, because people might be wondering, why is it called? We've made several references to the 3 days of Dapana. Why is it so called? Well, it started out in 1977 as a three-day race. And
don't tell me, Lionel, it was a three-day race.
It was a three-day race, Richard, yes. I always used to like going to it because it fell in the week leading up to the Tour of Flanders. They typically finish it on the Thursday afternoon. And the format was always the same in the years that I went. They'd have a kind of a sprintish stage on day one. Then they'd have a really kind of long, almost a semi-classic type race of sort of 230 kilometres on day two, a real kind of warm-up for the Tour of Flanders itself. And then on the third day, they'd have a short road stage in the morning and a little time trial around Dapana in the afternoon. And everyone would come out for it. And, you know, sometimes the weather would be absolutely appalling, and sometimes it would be, you know, a lovely, bright,
just terrible spring.
Exactly, yeah. The weather ranged from bloody awful to just unbearable. It was a real tough bike race. And I think, you know, every so often these races come along, you know, whether it be, I think back to Kerner, Brussels Kerner in 2010, when it was freezing cold and there were only 26 finishers. And that was a year that Ian Stannard got on the podium and Bobby Traxel won. But it was just bitterly cold, and most people succumbed to that cold. Or Gent-Wevelgem in 2009, where it rained heavily from the start. And you could see, I was in the team car that day, the Columbia team car, or High Road team car, whatever they were called at the time. Edvald Bosenhagen won the race for them, so it was pretty, you know, an exciting day driving through the peloton and following the lead group. But you could see from the expressions on the riders' faces who fancied it and who didn't. And this racing, it brings out those who are good at it, and you see some, you know, combinations of using the wind, using the roads, you know, digging in, trying to save energy, trying to put others on the rack. And we saw a bit of all of that this afternoon.
Yeah, I think it was a good. It's also a good summary of the strange season we had, because a 3 days race turned into a 1 day race. It's kind of what happened to the whole cycling season in a way, and I loved it. I'm not sure they used to ride like this 100 years ago, and like what Hugo said, but it was exciting in the way that it was really an elimination race. We don't see them that much you know anymore. Like, and if Van der Poel had not crashed, I mean, the leading group would have been skimmed again and again, and you know, only the strong survive in this sort of races. In the finale, we might have had, you know, just the stronger guys, and the fact that Van der Poel crashed changed the tactics a little bit, because instead of having three Alpes in against three Doconic Quickstep, then it was, you know, it was all down to Doconic Quickstep to take over, and the way they played tactically was absolutely perfect. When they found themselves, you know, three of them against the rest of the leading group, well, then it was not easy, but it was, you know, tactically it became a little bit, well, not simpler, but they played cleverly by sending Lampard up front, which was not probably the first choice or the guy you would have expected from the three Quickstep guys in the front to go for it. But it was even more of a surprise, I guess, for the rest of the leading bunch. They couldn't do anything. That's a little bit what Movistar did with Soler in the Vuelta. We're going to talk about later. Maybe the guy you didn't expect to go
well,
for it went
yeah,
for it.
I mean, they actually, they actually had four men in that break, and they played a bit of a blinder today. They kind of had to. We were still picking over the bones a little bit of the Tour of Flanders, of course, where they had Julian Alaphilippe up in the front group till he crashed. And then, as I discussed with Jan-Peter de Vlieger in Sunday's podcast, maybe made a bit of a mistake earlier on, not putting four men in the front group of, or rather three men in the front group of seven, rather than having one and three. And I did ask Yves Lampaert about that at the start in Bruges this morning, whether there was anything they could have done differently on Sunday.
Well, afterwards you can always say 10 scenarios of 10 scenarios you can say do different. I think the only thing we could have done is after time bar, when we were there with Bettiol and the guy from FDG, we had to close the gap, and then we were at seven with three guys of us. But okay, I thought the guys would close the gap because it was only 5 seconds. But the boy from FDG stopped riding, so it was a bit of a surprise. And then, the crash of Julien made it all worse for us.
And at that point, once Julien had crashed, was it just too difficult to close that gap? I mean, those two were very strong.
Those two were very strong. We were a big group. Of course, they look at us, but yeah, we were with three guys on 20. All the others are also with two or alone, but they also got benefit to close the gap, and then they look to us.
Well, that was Yves Lampaert speaking at the start. I know how to pick them, obviously. I spoke to him at the start. He went on and won the race, of course. But yeah, I mean, it was there was another element of the story, that lead group. Pretty much 50% of them are our best friends who train together every day. Lampaert and Tim de Klerk are very good friends and teammates, of course. Another Deceuninck Quickstep guy who was up there, Bert van Leerberg, he is also one of their training group, and Jonas Rijkaard of Alpes and Fenix. So they all train together all the time in those kinds of conditions, and there they were all duking it out today. I spoke to Rijkaard at the finish. He lost his team leader, Van der Poel, of course, in that crash. He seemed okay after the crash, but here is Jonas Rijkaard at the finish. Did you see what happened to Mathieu there?
Yeah, I was behind him. Someone went from the front to the back, and Mathieu touched him, and he went, in the side of the road, and he went hard to the ground, but I'm not sure how he's now. But
he went away in the team car, hard. So you know, he seemed okay. He was walking.
Okay, okay. So, but it was hard to see.
It spoiled the race for you because you had numbers up there. It would have been an interesting battle between yourselves and Deceuninck.
Yeah, of course we had three riders. They got four, but we got two fast men, and I had to try to anticipate or go in the attack. But yeah, Mathieu crashed and then yeah, I was on a gap. But yeah, when I came back, I was completely done.
And was it a fun day out there? Do you enjoy those conditions?
Yeah, I love this weather. I look forward to it, but. Yeah,
I understand. A lot of you guys know each other really well from training. You train together a lot.
Yeah. We're from the 1 and 2 guys. I train every day with them. So
four of you in the group were part of the same training group.
Yeah, of course, 4 of us. But yeah, I'm happy for them. But I would love to win for myself. But.
Well, that was Jonas Rijker of Alps and Fenix, and I also spoke at the finish to the winner again, Yves Lampaert. You like these conditions?
Yeah, for sure. It's I'm born in this region in West Flanders, so for me is it's an habitat that it's usual daily trainings for. So I really like the wind, the echelons, and the way they race today. So I was really happy to be in the first group.
And half the guys in the front group are your regular training group, aren't they?
Yeah. Valerbert, De Klerk, Rickard, we go training together a lot. So if you are there with your friends in the first group, it gives a boost to finish it off.
You have to think, I mean, at one point Alps and Fenix had 3 riders there. You know, were you worried about them? Were you thinking about how you would beat them?
Yeah, because they had the 2 main favourites, Van der Poel and Merlier. So our case was to make the race as hard as possible, and in the end I could go alone, and that gives a lot of that you are sure to win, so that was a lot better for us.
And you're very good friends with Tim De Klerk, aren't you? Nice to end the season on the podium with him.
Yeah, it's really incredible. Our first classic, Omloop Nieuwsblad, we were there with 2. He was 5th, I was 2nd. Today I win, he was 2nd. For a domestic rider as Tim, he's a big rider. A lot of people underestimate him, but he can ride incredibly fast. And he needs to have more confidence in himself, because sometimes he missed that. He always says, I'm not going to win, but if you see he's 2nd today, maybe he could win also.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. You can get 25% off all your Science in Sport goodies. It's time to stock up for winter. It certainly feels like winter already. So go to scienceandsport.com and enter the code SISCP25, SISCP25. And if you're getting on the Turbo Trainer, because it's getting colder, remember they have their Turbo Plus range designed to cool you down as you train indoors. Francois, you were going to just say something. We were lamenting the loss of Paris-Roubaix, but you were going to just say something about that. It was supposed to be on Sunday, of course.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I think that what made, you know, you said, you know, that usually the Bruges de Pan or 3 days, the Pan 3 days, that was not an exciting race. Usually, I think it was this time because it was the last, you know, the last one of this sort in this season. And really, what the kind of cycling we've seen on the in Flanders and all, and in Belgium and in all those places in the last couple of weeks, you know, it really makes you wonder how Roubaix would have gone. It would have been a really, I'm sure, a great addition. Well, and anyway, you know, what ifs. Anyway, let's go to the Vuelta then.
Well, I agree. Just a final word on Depana, because I did speak to Mark Cavendish. He didn't want to be interviewed, but he said how much he had loved the race today. He was in that front group, actually. He made the front echelon and he crashed, and he'd hurt himself, his left side, a little bit. Didn't seem too bad, but he was very disappointed to have ended his race and his season and maybe even his career like that. But speaking to one or two people around him, they said that he really does want to carry on, and I guess we'll see. He didn't have any news on that, and he certainly didn't want to say anything about it. But he still loves racing. That was very apparent. He still wants to be part of this, and he didn't. You know, he doesn't come across someone who's jaded and going through the motions at all. So you know, perhaps there is a way for Cavendish to carry on. We'll watch that space. But on to the Vuelta. And, well, it was, as you said earlier, Lionel, it was a kind of not dissimilar stage to stage one in a lot of ways. We didn't learn an awful lot new, did we? Apart from the fact that Movistar were very impressive, where Jumbo-Visma were very impressive. Yesterday, Movistar were really the team of the day, weren't they? Eric Maas is looking good, and they won the stage with Marc Soler.
Yeah, they did. In terms of the GC riders, it was all the same riders up there, apart from really Felix Grosschartner of Bora Hansgrohe, who lost a minute and has slipped down. It wasn't as demanding or as sophisticated a course as yesterday's. It really all hinged on the final climb and then the descent and run into the finish. Marc Soler won. As we said at the very start, it was only Movistar's second win of the season. I know it's a little bit unfair and a bit strange to talk about how long it's taken for teams to get victories on in this year because it's been so unusual. But it is
the least expected win. Oh, the least expected win.
You literally big-footed me. I was setting myself up for the least expected win. Of course, the Netflix documentary about Movistar.
Starring Marc Soler's toys out the pram.
Well, he had his tantrum, didn't he, when he was told to go back and work for teammates. It was a good job that Soler didn't have the opportunity to watch today's Giro stage, because over in Italy, Movistar showed how not to do it, because they got four riders into the break of 19, and then when that break split in half, they got three riders in the first 10, and then when the climbing started on the way up to Madonna di Campiglio, they all went backwards and squandered what would have been a numerical advantage. But here Soler seized the initiative, and it did look impressive. He looked strong. I think the one thing that was in his favour was that he lost a little bit of time yesterday, and so there was no reason for the likes of Roglic or Carapaz or Dan Martin to really react. And of course he had Valverde and Mas in the group as well, so Movistar played it well, and it's going to be really interesting to see how this trio of Movistar riders managed to put together a GC challenge, which you would imagine would be for Enric Mas. He's finished on the podium at the Vuelta before, of course, and although they didn't have a very good Tour de France, not very high profile Tour de France, Mas did finish fifth overall. I mean, he kind of snuck
Alain Zubeldia
very much so snuck up there. It was all gains made in that final week, but that's what Grand Tour racing is about, isn't it? It isn't necessarily how you start, it's how you finish. And well, while we saw Soler win the stage, we didn't learn an awful lot about the rest of the GC riders. Roglic didn't look overly concerned when Carapaz accelerated on the top of the climb. He waited for everybody else to kind of jump onto Carapaz's wheel and fall into line before he slotted in. I think probably knew, didn't need to do too much today. There's a long way still to go. But that group of 8, 9, 10 riders is looking like it's set fair, certainly for the first half of the race, whenever the climbs, until we get to the Tourmalet on Sunday. And again, the question there will be about how far up the Tourmalet they can go. We know that the GC battle is kind of, I think, between Roglic and Carapaz with the others simmering behind, yeah.
Well, we've got a few diarists at the Vuelta. Nick Dlamini of NTT, Nick Schultz of Michelin Scott, and Scott Davis of Bahrain McLaren, with George Bennett of Jumbo-Visma and Mitch Docker of EF Pro Cycling also chipping in. But we've got a new diarist tonight, haven't we, Lionel? We're going to hear from our new diarist now. Let's see what he's got to tell us.
Evening, chaps. My first dispatch from La Vuelta in Navarra today. We had a stage win for Movistar. A rare win for them today. Second win of the season, I think. First World Tour win since last year's Vuelta. They were on home turf, of course. They're based in Navarra. Their main director sportif, José Luis Arrieta, lives pretty much on the course today, and I spoke to Carlos Verona at the finish, and he said that Arri, as they call him, his sort of local knowledge was key today for Marc Soler to win the stage. But I said we're in Navarra. There's a lot of angst and anxiety in this region at the moment about COVID, coronavirus. Tomorrow, there's a lockdown starting whereby all non-essential travel is going to be forbidden, I think, in Navarra. The restaurants are closing. A lot of local restaurateurs and hoteliers are pretty upset. We saw a pretty noisy protest in Pamplona just after the start today. and our hotel owners, and we just checked into our hotel tonight. They're also pretty upset with what's going to happen tomorrow. I said non-essential travel is going to be limited. I think the Vuelta leaving Navarra will qualify as relatively essential. Certainly, if it's going to make its way around northern Spain, which we're due to do. So I think we're going to be okay. The race starting tomorrow and leaving tomorrow. As far as the race is concerned, as you'll have seen, Rog still in red and looking good. Immediately yesterday after the stage to Arrate, looking at how everyone rode there and just thinking about how they've come into this race, I sort of identified, or I thought, there were four outstanding candidates for victory. So that would be Rog, Carapaz, Enric Mas, I think, is looking really good. And I think Sepp Kuss is looking really good. And I think if Jumbo-Visma can keep him in the high up the GC, which they didn't manage to do in the Tour de France, I think he could really make their collective strength pay. And it might be that he ends up being stronger than Roglic. A lot of mountains in this Vuelta, so it's a great course for Sepp Kuss. I spoke to Tom Dumoulin at the finish today, and he said, well, it's about time that Sepp got his opportunity. And I think that the way Jumbo-Visma are talking and the way they're shaping up, this could indeed be Sepp Kuss's first opportunity to go for the GC in a Grand Tour, either as Roglic's deputy or sort of as the main man. I mentioned Dumoulin, slightly worried about him, worried that he's quite so pessimistic, defeatist about his own form, says he feels tired, says he felt pretty terrible today. I just hope that he sticks around for the next few days and indeed finishes the race, and I'm sure Rog does as well. Chris Froome's had his problems as well the first couple of days. Everyone will have seen that. He was well off the pace again today. Another rider, slightly worried about, Thibaut Pinot, is completely out of sorts, still complaining about the back problems he had at the Tour de France. Led to believe that he might not be around for very long in this Vuelta, which is a real shame. On paper, this looked like a great opportunity for him to as he told me yesterday morning, start enjoying his cycling again, which he hasn't done for a long time, but that certainly hasn't been the case the first couple of days. And yeah, seen against the backdrop of, you know, this wave of young talent emerging, Almeida at the Giro, Pogacar and so on and so forth, we've talked about it a lot. Those various ills and worries of Froome, Dumoulin and Pinot might make one slightly misty-eyed about the generation, a generation on its way out, or certainly moving towards the twilight of their careers. Hope that's not the case. Dumoulin and Pinot are certainly young enough to have several good years ahead of them. But yeah, we'll be following them, those two riders in particular, with interest tomorrow, Dumoulin and Pino. I think they have to get through tomorrow, another mountain stage, with spirits and body also intact. So we'll see how they get on. That's about all from me for tonight, chaps. More updates to come. And I hope you're enjoying the racing. I would suggest after 2 days, it's shaping up to be a more exciting race than the Giro. Don't know what you think.
Well, that was a wistful and misty-eyed Daniel Freeb there. That's great to hear from him, and we'll be hearing from him throughout the Vuelta. Some interesting thoughts from him, very much sort of mourning the passing of the old guard. You know, Pinot, Dumoulin, Froome, all of them have varying degrees of problems or issues or challenges at this Vuelta, it seems. I was interested to hear him tipping Sepp Kuss, who he was suggesting could emerge. Has the hashtag Free Sepp Kuss campaign started yet? Because there was a moment today when he appeared to be taking flight and sort of checked his effort because Roglic was behind, and the hierarchy seems pretty clear there.
Yeah, there was a Jane Lee moment, like at the Giro. You know, you have the impression that the leaders are kind of holding back their leading teammates. You know, and there was an interesting comment from Jackie Durand, French TV, saying he'd known guys like Sepp Kuss in the past in the peloton. Guys like, if you tell them you're the leader of the team, that they underperform. But when you tell them, okay, you'll be the leading, you know, the last man and the right hand man to the leader, then they perform very well. And that's that's what Sepco seems to be doing. You're Daniel was mentioning the decline of the old guard, and we had news today that Nairo Quintana, a former Vuelta winner, of course, had both his knee surgery to both his knees, so he had obviously, you know, knees issues. So there you are. Yeah, I mean, all these guys, Dumoulin, Pinot, Froome, Quintana, they all seem to be, you know, on the mend for the time being. We'll see. Maybe next season we're all in a way, you know, hoping for the old guard at least for a couple of years or maybe 1 year to still, you know, try to lift the gauntlet from the young generation. We'll see what will happen. Go ahead, Lionel.
Just on Dumoulin, because I said Groschartner was the only overall contender who slipped back today. Perhaps that's because after yesterday, we didn't necessarily consider Dumoulin a GC contender here. He lost 51 seconds yesterday, a lot more time lost today. He was struggling on the sort of grippy concrete roads. Not really his terrain, this, I don't think, these kind of climbs. Not really climbs where he can get into his real time trialing rhythm. And he was drifting off the back a bit. Looked like he got himself back in touch at one point, but then the motorbike went past and he seemed to sort of give up the ghost a little bit. Conceded 8 minutes 20 today, so he's out of the picture really as far as GC goes, but will nevertheless be a big help to Roglic and Mass and Bennett when you get to the more conventional mountain stages.
I think that's a surprise, though. I mean, I still consider him a GC contender even last night. And you know, George Bennett, who we had on Kilometre Zero the other day, said that, you know, Roglic was sort of plan 1A and Dumoulin was plan 1B. Well, it seems now that Sepp Kuss is maybe 1B and Dumoulin is 1E, I guess.
Yeah,
I think it's interesting the way, because Lionel, you were saying that, you know, Roglic didn't look that interested when Carapaz went, or even less when Soler went, when he actually held Sepp Kuss back a little bit there. But in the same time, he's riding quite differently from the Tour de France. In the Tour, you know, he waited almost till the last minute to take. He seemed reluctant to take the yellow jersey, and on this Vuelta, he took the red jersey on the first day, and today he jumped in the finale to grab a couple of bonus seconds to finish in second in the stage. So he probably learned his lesson that, you know, every second and every bonus counts, and which is interesting as well.
We should say that Dan Martin and Hugh Carthy also riding extremely well in the opening days, the opening 2 days of the Vuelta. But they set off at such a pace, haven't they? It's a shortened Vuelta, but it's almost impossible to imagine they're going to sustain this over 18 days.
Do you not think, though, that for guys like Dan Martin and Hugh Carthy, having a Grand Tour that starts literally with the important stages, no stressful kind of... No messing about. They know exactly where they need to be.
Tippy-tappy prologues or anything like that.
Well, you know, you see, don't you, Dan Martin's been on the back foot early on in Grand Tours before, and you know, some riders don't like those nervous early days. So for some people, they'll
be relishing.
So much
for the holiday Grand Tour, Lionel.
Well, but then the point is, when we do have some flat stages, which would ordinarily be nervous type days if the GC hadn't settled down, because the GC pattern has been set. I think that, you know, the riders who might not necessarily enjoy the scrap for positioning and fight for wheels and the people that tend to get caught out when splits happen, that kind of thing may not happen for them. Just one rider who we knew already last night wasn't going to be featuring in the GC race. Chris Froome was sampling the Gruppetto a bit today, wasn't he? He was in the second of three large groups. His group came in 18 minutes 44 down. Just before we finish up, let's hear from Mitch Docker, who is going to be sending us his thoughts from the Vuelta. Of course, he has his own podcast, Life in the Peloton, the latest episode of which is out now and features a commissaire, Greg Griffith. So if you want to know what the race commissaires do, have a listen to Life in the Peloton. But here is Mitch Docker and his first impressions of the Vuelta from yesterday.
G'day, I'm Mitch Stocker and I ride for EF Pro Cycling, and I'm going to be doing some feedback or diary for the Vuelta España 2020. So we've done the first stage, we're here, and it was a tough first stage actually. It really felt like stage four, where it should have really been. As you know, this Vuelta is going to be three stages short. It was supposed to start in Holland, and yesterday's stage was supposed to be the fourth stage. So it was the first stage now, and it did feel like the fourth stage. Got in the hotel last night and I was pretty tired already. I was thinking, God, I've only done one stage. And I think that's got to do with the weather. It was much colder, it was wet, and the racing was just pretty tough. Tough day, fast, you know, uphill finish. So the race is well and truly underway. I guess one of the most weirdest things I've noticed so far with this race is the light. The race is starting quite late. You know, we started yesterday at 1 o'clock. Today we're going to start at 2 o'clock. And so when we finish, we're driving in the dark. It's very weird. You get into the hotel, it's completely dark. It's very Vuelta-esque. You know, you're doing massage at 8 o'clock. You still got to have dinner. Last night I didn't finish dinner till 10:30. But it's pitch black outside. So that is quite weird. And I think that's playing on also that level of tiredness, you know, as naturally the body's starting to wind down this time of year, and with the light getting darker, that is also adding to it. So in saying all that, we're only one day deep. There's still a lot of days to come. So that's my first thoughts of this year's Vuelta.
Well, not so much the holiday Grand Tour if it's dark as soon as they finished, is it? No time to go to the beach.
The nocturnal Grand
very
Tour.
Good. Yeah, very yeah. Good. It is.
Oh, well. another two and a half weeks to go of that. No, only two races on tomorrow, though, chaps. We're going to be bereft. What are we going to do with ourselves?
Yeah.
On that third screen.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I might. Yeah, I don't know what the problem will be to choose what screens to leave. Out of it. You know. Decisions. Yeah.
I've got to go in and select my packet of crisps.
Yeah.
Francois, you've got to decide whether to drink your Italian bottle of wine or your Spanish bottle of wine first.
I'll go for the three of them. You know, start with a beer for the pan, and then it's Italian wine, and then probably a Spanish wine to finish. I just wanted to we don't mention sometimes the nobodies of the World Tour, and these races are among the last of the season. So some guys, you know, will end not only the season but their career. And we learned from AG2R La Mondiale that Axel Domon, who crashed in the Vuelta today, was actually, I mean, it's the end of his career. He ended his career on a crash. He knew it was his last race, and unfortunately for him, that's the way it ends.
And AG2R are down about three riders already, aren't they, at the Vuelta?
Yeah, not a great season finish for them, but there you are. Yeah, so I lift my glass to Axel Domon, all the guys who were, well, there might be quite a few. You mentioned Cav, but there might be others who's.
Speaking of another AG2R rider, though, Larry Warbass, did he have a good day at the Giro today? I didn't notice, but today's stage started in Balsano del Grappa, where, of course, Hemingway stayed and set a couple of books there. We had Larry reading the opening to one of them last year across the river and into the trees. And he's from the same part of the world. So did Larry get on today, Lionel? Has he kept on to his top 20 position?
Larry Warbass today was 7:47 off the race winner, so 2.75 minutes down on the GC group, and overall he is still 20th, he's gone down a place, sorry, from 19th to 20th, and he's a couple of minutes and 2.5 minutes or so ahead of Sam Omen. So,
oh well, not a bad day, not too bad a day. Anyway, that's all for tonight. We'll be joining, or you'll be joining us again tomorrow night, Francois. Look forward to that. And enjoy your wine and beer.
Thank you.
And speak to you tomorrow.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Francois. Thank you, Lionel.
Thanks, Rich. Enjoy your petrol station sandwich. On my third screen tomorrow, I might re-watch The Least Expected Day, the Netflix Movistar documentary.